to the Royal Albert Hall for this evening's prom. It's presented by Louise Fryer.
It's a programme of contrasts in tonight's prom, with the BBC Symphony Orchestra under their principal guest conductor David Robertson combining the classicism of Mozart and Haydn with two very different works by Béla Bartók. His third piano concerto, Richard Good, the soloist, composed after Bartók left Europe and was living in the United States. And the BBC singers and the symphony chorus join the orchestra for an earlier work full of earthy Central European mysticism, Bartók's dramatic Cantata Profana, based on an old Romanian folk ballad about hunters becoming the hunted as a group of brothers living wild in the mountains are magically transformed into stags. Well, there are plenty of unlikely transformations in one of Mozart's most successful operas, The Magic Flute, composed in 1791, the last year of Mozart's brief life. The opera is based on a complex Oriental fairy tale in which the young hero, Tamino, falls in love with Pamina, daughter of the evil Queen of the Night. Mozart weaves in all sorts of Masonic references too. We're going to hear the overture, which bears little relation to the story. In fact, it seems to have been something of an afterthought. The date on the score suggests it was composed only 2 days before the opera's first performance at the Freihaus Theater auf der Wieden in Vienna on the 5th of September 1791. Musically, overture and opera are linked only by the triple wind chords, a symbolic Masonic knocking figure that added an air of majestic solemnity. But the main part of the overture is a lively contrapuntal allegro. The BBC Symphony Orchestra is in place. The men in their white DJs, the ladies in all black. And here comes the leader of the orchestra, Stephen Bryant. And that applause greets the arrival of David Robertson, making the first of his two proms appearances this season as principal guest conductor of the Symphony Orchestra, ready to conduct the overture to Mozart's The Magic Flute.
Thank you.
Is set for a story of ritual and the passage to enlightenment with the overture to Mozart's The Magic Flute. David Robertson conducting the BBC Symphony Orchestra. Well, more parables to come after the interval with a Romanian rite of passage tale given a dramatic choral treatment in 1930 by Béla Bartók. Before that, a work Bartók composed at the very end of his life in 1945, his third piano concerto. The previous 5 years had been unsettled ones. In 1940, Bartók and his wife made the heartbreaking decision to leave their home, friends and family in Hungary, where they found the pro-Nazi regime increasingly difficult to endure, and headed off to make a new beginning in America. As a visiting associate in music at Columbia University, Bartók was kept busy, but also kept guessing. The appointment wouldn't last for long, he knew, and it was soon clear that concert engagements wouldn't fill the diary. In the land of plenty, the Bartóks found themselves in a very frightening situation. They were living in New York, had little money, and very little way of earning more. Bartók composed with difficulty during those hard years, and then, after persistent health problems in 1944, he was diagnosed with leukemia. The third piano concerto was the last work he completed. He died just a few days later, on the 26th of September, 1945. Tonight's soloist with the BBC Symphony Orchestra is the great American pianist Richard Good. He's best known for his interpretations of Beethoven, but Bartók's third piano concerto is very close to his heart.
It's basically a classical piece. I love classic form, and it has a very, very clear and beautiful form. The writing of the piano and orchestra is marvelously clear. At the same time, it has one of the most touching and deep slow movements I think Bartók ever wrote, one which is in some ways consolatory and religious in feeling. At the same time, it combines that with the nature music. I always feel as if the second movement begins almost in a church, and then in the middle, the church dissolves, and you're in the outer world, the world that I think Bartók, in a way, felt was in his world. Also, of course, the circumstances of the composition, and Bartók wrote it when he knew he was dying. It was a gift to his wife, the pianist, and he knew that after he died, she would be able to play this piece. As it turned out, I think she didn't play the piece for many years because it was so painful, the circumstances, that she wouldn't play it.
Tonight, soloist Richard Good. Bartók was still valiantly orchestrating the very end of the score when he was taken to hospital and died, leaving just 17 final bars of musical shorthand to be deciphered and scored by his friend Tibor Sherley. Here comes Richard Good, the soloist at this BBC Proms, together with the BBC Symphony Orchestra conducted by David Robertson, for the third piano concerto by Béla Bartók.
Thank you.
First of two works in this BBC Prom by Béla Bartók, the American pianist Richard Good, the soloist in Bartók's third piano concerto, with David Robertson conducting the BBC Symphony Orchestra. Alongside the Hungarian dance rhythms, Bartók also took inspiration from the natural world in that piece, including in the middle movement you might have noticed real bird song that he noted down on a trip to North Carolina. In this morning's rehearsal at the end of the first movement, David Robertson turned to Richard Good and said simply, "Beautiful." And I think the audience here at the Royal Albert Hall agree. Richard Good returning to the platform, shaking hands with the leader, Richard Bryant, and then taking a deep bow. He's wearing a tailcoat, which you don't see soloists wear so often these days. He's not a tall man. He was physically sliding from one side of the piano stool to the other during those sequences of rising chords which covered the whole length of the keyboard in that final movement. A very modest man, David Robertson, having to encourage him to step a little closer to the audience just then. He was renowned for his Beethoven and Brahms. This is one of the few 20th century piano concertos in Richard Good's repertoire, partly because of its classical proportions. He first played it 35 years ago, he says, drawn by its clarity and shapeliness, making it a world away from the pianistic pyrotechnics of Bartók's earlier piano concertos. And he's back at the piano, and we think he's going to have an encore, but he's just taking the piano music off the stand. from Bartok to Bach. That was the Saraband from Bach's Keyboard Partita No. 1 in B-flat major, an encore for Richard Good. And conductor David Robertson sneaking back onto the stage and sitting behind the strings to listen to it. Richard Good was born in New York in 1943. In his 60-odd years, he's won numerous piano prizes, including the first prize in the Clara Haskell competition, the Avery Fisher Prize, a Grammy Award with clarinetist Richard Stoltzman, and the first ever Jean Gimbel Lane Prize in piano performance. That was in 2006. And the members of the BBC Symphony Orchestra applauding him as he threads his way past. Well, in 20 minutes after the interval here on BBC Radio 3, the Symphony Orchestra and David Robertson return with music by Haydn, his Symphony No. 102, one of the London symphonies, and Mont Bartok, one of the few choral works he wrote and one deeply embedded in the pagan traditions of his Central European roots, his Cantata Profana, based on a Romanian folk ballad. American tenor Nicholas Pahn is one of the soloists, together with baritone Ashley Holland, and they join the BBC Singers and the BBC Symphony Chorus. By way of introduction to the Cantata Profana, the writer Meg Rozoff recalls a Hungarian children's classic by Kate Sheridy, The Good Master, which she loved as a child, and which she now sees has much in common with the work of Bartok. Here she is with Bartok and The Good Master.
Everything I know about rural Hungary, I learned from Kate Sheridy, a Hungarian-born writer of children's books, born in 1892. Her best-known novel, The Good Master, was published within a few years of Bartok's Cantata Profana, and my older sister received it as a gift for her 12th birthday in 1967. My sister and I fought over that book more or less incessantly. We also fought over magazines, clothes, shoes, Grateful Dead LPs, bell-bottom jeans, and whose turn it was to clean the fish tank. Our beautiful childhood copy of The Good Master has the slightly smudgy, well-worn, and dog-eared look of a much-loved childhood favourite. Its condition attests to an endless number of readings and re-readings over the years. Recently, I found the original copy, with the inscription, "To Annie, on her birthday," on my bookshelf in London, 3,000 miles away from my sister's home, which suggests that I won the battle for possession in the end. When writing this piece, I phoned to ask if she still remembered and loved The Good Master as much as I do. "Oh, heavens, yes," said she, a little dreamily, her voice clouding over suddenly. I wonder whatever happened to the copy I got for my 12th birthday. I changed the subject. The Good Master tells the story of Kate, a skinny, wayward, motherless 10-year-old sent from Budapest to live with her uncle and his family in the Hungarian countryside. Cousin Kate's father, in a gross example of understatement, describes his daughter as delicate, by which he really means headstrong and utterly uncontrollable. The word delicate, so at odds with hearty country life, causes her innocent boy cousin to create an idealized image of the girl he expects to arrive from Budapest.
Jancsi thought that houses in Budapest were made of gold and had diamond windows. All the city people rode around on pure white horses and wore silk gowns. Cousin Kate would have golden curls, rosy cheeks, big blue eyes. She would wear a white silk flowing gown, and her voice would be like honey. Someday, a dragon would capture her, and it will be up to him to go to the rescue.
Jancsi is shocked, disappointed, and not a little impressed by the dirty-faced, pugilist tomboy who arrives by train, the first train he has ever seen. Clever and worldly wise, she shoves him off the side of the family wagon at the earliest opportunity, causes the horses to bolt, and on arriving at her new home, looking like a sleepy kitten and a poor motherless lamb, proceeds to climb up onto the rafters of the kitchen to eat through the family's supply of sausages, left drying for the winter. Kate becomes known as the screaming monkey, for she has an unfortunate habit of shrieking at the top of her lungs when riled. She splits her petticoats so she can learn to ride horseback, and Jancsi discovers to his cost that she is at her most angelic-looking when plotting mischief. But in due course, thanks to the discipline of farm life and her uncle's wisdom and love, Kate begins to change. Tradition, family ties, and the great sweeping beauty of the Hungarian plain worked their own magic on the motherless city child.
Everything was quiet. A breathless hush came over the plains. Not a blade of grass stirred, not a sound could be heard. Even the starlings, clamouring noisily but a little while ago, were silent. Yonchi pointed to the east. From the distant, shadowy line where earth and sky merged together, golden shafts of light rose, piercing the white mist over the plains. A few lingering stars flickered and were drowned in the brightening sky. Then slowly, majestically, the red sun rose above the horizon. It seemed to hover for a second, as if reluctant to tear itself away from the earth. Then it came into full view, painting everything to the smallest seedling in Kate's garden with its glorious light. The full-throated warble of a robin rose from the apple tree, heralding the new day. Kate sighed deeply. I've never seen a sunrise before.
The good master of the title is Yonchi's father, Martin Nagy, a traditional Hungarian landowner. Strong, handsome, educated, straight-backed, hard-working, wise, moral, fair, and the best horseman in the land. Sigh. He exhibits an abundance of love for his family, the shepherds and herders who work on his large estate, his sheep, his horses and cattle. He harbors above all a deep respect and passion for the land, and makes a pretty good template for anyone's ideal husband and father. As someone with a squandered youth spent endlessly flirting with versions of the bad master, I was relieved finally to meet the man who is to be my husband and discover that most of his qualities measured up to Martin Nagy, though he is quite definitely not the best horseman in the land. But I digress. The good master is set in the early years of the 19th century, just before the outbreak of World War I. Anyone who has read George Orwell's Coming Up for Air or Siegfried Sassoon's Memoirs of a Fox Hunting Man will recognize this period of history as the calm before the storm, the golden idyll before the outbreak of the First Great War, the modern world's loss of innocence. In Hungary, the early 20th century was a time of great uncertainty, a time in which the decline of a traditional pastoral existence had already begun to seem inevitable. Rural life had been under attack for some time, devastated by cholera epidemics, ravaged by drought and famine, undermined by the over-partitioning of property, creeping industrialization, and the lure of the city. The traditional feudal way of life that had structured society in rural Hungary for hundreds of years was, unquestionably, on the run. In the midst of this decline, Martin, the good master, stands firm as the head of a traditional extended community, which is dependent upon him for safe and steady employment, protection in bad times, and the right to earn a peaceful living from the land.
Pista the shepherd opened the painted chest. "Honour me, little lady, by selecting anything you like," he said in his quaint, courteous way. There were hundreds of trinkets in the chest, rings, chains, bracelets, little square and round boxes, carved spoons, forks, cups, salt cellars, all were beautifully inlaid and painted. "Do you really make these yourself?" she asked.
"All of them, little lady. Sheep herding leaves a lot of time on my hands, so I just keep myself occupied by whittling."
"What are they made of? They're beautiful," cried Kate, handling a delicate necklace.
"Ram's horns, wood, bones, roots, anything I can find. I make my paints from herbs and roots. The Lord gave us everything. I just find them and use them."
"But don't you sell them? They're more beautiful than any jewellery I ever saw in stores. You can make a lot of money."
"That's what I always tell him," said Father, stepping closer. "He's an artist, a great one, and doesn't know it. He should earn money and study in schools."
Pista turned to him seriously.
"What would a shepherd be doing with money, Mr. Nagy? I have everything here. I'm happy."
"Look," he said, stretching his arms wide, turning to the open doorway. "Look! The sky gives me sunshine and rain. The ground gives me food. The spring gives me water. The sheep give me shelter and clothes. The beautiful flowers, the animals, the birds show me what to carve with my knife. Can money and school give me better things?"
Pista is as ideal an illustration of the country shepherd as Martin Nagy is of the good master. He perfectly embodies the peaceful, useful rural economy that by the time of the writing of the book was disappearing. Never mind that Sheridy's characters are idealized. Not all masters would have been quite so glowingly good. And what with disease, political unrest, and famine, the life of a 19th-century Hungarian peasant was unlikely to have been anywhere near as idyllic as Pista's. Sheridy's triumph is to have captured the essence of this perfect harmony between man and nature at a particular moment in history. One of the joys of the good master was the great range of traditional rural crafts Sheridy describes in her book. Through chapter after chapter, her characters prepare and spin flax, make sausages, carve chairs, and decorate Easter eggs. Such descriptions enthralled my sister and me, two typical suburban American children of the 1960s. Our mother bought egg dyeing kits at Woolworth's that came complete with fizzy tablets of dye and little wire egg hooks to produce all over turquoise or pink or green eggs. We certainly didn't channel fine lines of melted wax and elaborate patterns over and over to create miniature works of art. Tablecloths came from Mary Mecco's store on Battle Street in Cambridge. Lord knows we didn't ask Father to put in an extra acre of flax in order to spin thread and weave linen with heart-shaped patterns along the edge. Hot dogs arrived from the supermarket in packets of 12. No pig had its throat cut in our barn, in part because we lived in the leafy Boston suburbs and had no barn, and in part because, being Jewish, we weren't likely to keep pigs. When Kate's father finally returns to his brother's house for Christmas, he sees for himself the magic wrought on his unruly daughter and finds himself gradually drawn back towards the landscape of his childhood. A Christmas blizzard wraps the house in a blanket of snow. Brother Martin takes out his woodworking tools, and Shandor's own transformation begins.
"We need some new chairs, Mother," said Martin. Yonchi helped him find well-seasoned dry maple planks in the woodshed. Uncle Shandor shook his head and smiled. "So you still make your own furniture. I don't see how you have patience for it when you can buy furniture so cheaply now." Father grunted. "Glued and nailed factory rubbish. I want furniture we can use, not rickety stuff like that. Besides, I have nothing else to do now. Shall I twiddle my thumbs and look at the snow?" He measured and cut out seats and backs, rungs and legs for future chairs. Uncle Shandor looked on for a while. Then he grew restless. Suddenly he exclaimed, "I haven't had an honest tool in my hand since I left for the city. Got a spare saw, brother?" Father laughed. "I knew you couldn't resist it, Shandor. There isn't a man who can resist the song of the saw." Soon, Uncle Shandor was working, humming and whistling to himself. Evenings, the shepherds helped too. One by one, the rough pieces were planed and whittled, smoothed and rubbed down. Leisurely, carefully, painstakingly, they worked until each piece fitted the other perfectly. Then they were fastened together with wooden dowels. Father threw himself on the first complete chair with all his weight. "Built for a lifetime," he exclaimed with satisfaction. Mother was teaching Kate to spin. In the fall, a little after harvest time, she had prepared the flax. Kate told her father how it was done. "We soaked it first, Daddy, soaked it in big tubs for 2 days, then dried it in the sun. Later on, Auntie showed me how to break the hard fibres in the flax. She has a machine. Then we tied the flax in sheaves and combed it with a wire comb to make it all smooth and even. Here it is, Daddy, on the spinning wheel. See? I can make a nice long thread." She could too. The thread she made was just as thin and even as Mother's. Uncle Shandor looked at Mother. "What have you done to the child, my dear? I sent a spoiled, cranky, pale little girl to you, and I find a husky, happy, busy little farmer. She will never fit into city life again."
Of course, no description of the good master would be complete without music. Béla Bartók and Kate Sheridy both exploited a fierce interest in the traditional songs and stories of rural Hungary. Both were born in the Hungary of the last decades of the 19th century. Both eventually left Hungary for America, and looking back, drew heavily on traditional Magyar folk legends and songs. In the company of fellow composer Zoltán Kodály, Bartók spent a number of years travelling the remote Carpathian regions and across Eastern Europe, collecting and transcribing traditional music, saving it from oblivion by modernization.
A whole city of tents and booths had sprung up overnight. Thousands of people thronged the alleys between the booths, buying and selling, shouting and laughing. Worries about crops and animals were forgotten. It was the day of days, the country fair. Gypsy music, singing, shepherds, flutes, horns, drums, whistles and trumpets, the hoarse cries of dealers, laughter, the neighing and bellowing from the cattle show, the glorious, happy din could be heard for miles. Inside the tent it was cool and shady. Long, narrow tables had been set up. People were crowded around them, but willingly made room for the newcomers. When Father asked Jonci what he wanted to eat, even the man who waited on them laughed. A big piece of chocolate cake with a pink coat, a mug of chocolate with a white hat on it, and a bottle of that green drink, he said, pointing to the rows of soda pop on the counter. Bound to get a tummy ache, aren't you, son? Well, the fair comes only once a year. While they were eating, a gypsy band came in. Whoops and hurrahs greeted them. Grinning as only gypsies can, they started to play. They played sad tunes, lively tunes, swaying with the rhythm of their own music. People began to sing. Young men jumped up one after the other. They threw money to the swarthy leader, ordering songs for their friends, best girls, mothers. Jonci watched them, his face eager. Suddenly, his eyes sparkled. Father, will my money buy a tune from the gypsies?
Just about one tune.
What is your song, mother? Asked Jonci. My song?
Why, a chardash, said mother.
Jonci got up, threw back his shoulders, hitched up his belt and walked to the leaders. He threw his silver coin on the floor like the other men. Here, play a chardash for my mother, he ordered in a loud voice. She listened with shining eyes. Kate tapped her heels on the floor to the rhythm of the lively chardash. Can you dance, Jonci? She asked.
Course I can dance the chardash.
Want to? He held out his hands to her. The gypsies played faster and faster. Other couples joined the dance. They pushed the tables aside. Soon everybody was dancing, even father and mother.
Bartók's Cantata Profana is based on the secular pre-Christian story of the nine enchanted stags. A hunter sends his nine sons out to hunt and is dismayed to discover they have been transformed into stags. When he begs them to return to hearth and home in human form, they reject him, choosing instead the life of wild animals in the forest. Bartók may have felt attracted to the story as an implicit rejection of modern life, with its psychological as well as physical alienations. The story is a dark one, and we can hear the loss of a way of life, the anger and disappointment of the father, and the violent rejection of civilization in every note of the music. The transcriptions of folk tales woven throughout Sheridy's book are somewhat tamer. But in a recent rereading, I noticed something about the stories that I never picked up as a child. Each tale, told by the shepherd, the miller, the old horseman, features armies, cruel soldiers intent on pillage and destruction. In a world of almost unrelenting goodness, this suddenly struck me as an odd counterpoint. One cruel legion of soldiers is lured off in search of the legendary wealth hidden in a mirage village. Another army swoops down from the Milky Way. The stories, of course, echo the complex and violent history of Hungary, from the Magyars and Huns united against barbarian and Roman armies, all the way through to violent government troops sent to quell rural uprisings in the 20th century, the fall of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, and the rise of fascism. Although the honest country folk always win the day in Sheridy's tales, the sense of a threatened existence, of a dangerous outside world held off, just, this time, but maybe not next time, creeps through. But don't all fairy tales contain an element of threat? And doesn't all of life? By the end of the book, Kate's transformation is complete, thanks to the ministrations of the good master and honest country living. Although the book's sequel tells the story of an altogether grimmer Hungary caught up in World War I, it is the final image of the good master that stays with the reader. A family at Christmas, cocooned by the snow, glowing with reunion, resolution, and love. It's easy to imagine Charity, now an emigre living on a farm a few hours north of New York City, remembering a childhood idyll, preserving it for herself and for generations of her readers forever. Whenever I feel a bit beleaguered and pigeonholed by the title of teen writer, I think about the powerful effect the books I read in my teens had on my own worldview. When I wrote How I Live Now in 2003, nearly 40 years after I read The Good Master, the story of the wayward city girl who goes to live with her cousins in the country seemed a perfectly natural story to tell. It didn't occur to me at the time that the ghost of Kate Sheridy's story, deeply etched on my brain, was lurking down inside the foundations of my own book. Which came first in my own life? I sometimes wonder. The attraction to simplicity, or the books that describe country life so wonderfully that it became an obsession? It is impossible to unpick the strands. But despite more than 30 years divided between New York City and London, my longing for the life and landscape of The Good Master has not diminished over time. This year, after a lifetime of imagining tidy villages, snowy hand-woven linen tablecloths, and virgin meadows filled with wildflowers, I booked a horse-riding trip across the foothills of the Carpathian Mountains in Romania, through villages untouched by the modern world, preserved, no doubt, thanks to poverty and the remoteness of the region. I'm looking forward to the painted churches, the local culinary delicacies, and most of all, to riding horseback across a landscape virtually unchanged since Yanchi, Kate, and Arpad the herdsman rode across the Good Master's estate a century ago. At last, I'll have a chance to see it for myself.
That was the writer Meg Rozoff with Bartok and The Good Master. The reader was Christine Kavanagh and the producer was B.T. Rubens. Welcome back from me, Louise Fryer, to the Royal Albert Hall and tonight's Prom broadcast live on BBC Radio 3. It's given by the BBC Symphony Orchestra under their principal guest conductor, David Robertson, and they'll be ending with Haydn's Symphony No. 102. Before that, they're joined by the BBC Singers and the BBC Symphony Chorus and soloists Nicholas Pahn and Ashley Holland for music by Bartok that post-dates the Austro-Hungarian Empire Haydn would have known, but for its source delves back way before it to a folk ballad allowing the atheist Bartok to write a cantata, traditionally a Christian musical form, that has nature rather than the Christian God as its presiding deity. In April 1914, on a folk song collecting tour in Transylvania, Bartok recorded two versions of a Romanian colinda, a Yuletide song with many verses. The melodies were different, but the words belonged to the same epic folk ballad. In the late 1920s, he commissioned a translation of the poems into Hungarian, which he didn't think much of, and he wrote himself. He composed the cantata in 1930, influenced by the original melodies of the ballad which he'd recorded. Cantata Profana, as we've been hearing, is a parable. Here tonight's conductor, David Robertson, who just happens to speak fluent Hungarian.
I wonder if it isn't one of the first ecologically informed musical stories of the 20th century. It's a fascinating story in that it begins and says there was this person who had these wonderful sons, and they were handsome and gorgeous, but he didn't teach them animal husbandry, and he didn't teach them farming, and he didn't teach them all of these different crafts. He only taught them to hunt in the hills and in the mountains, which was very exciting, but that's all they knew how to do. And then they indeed are going hunting, and there's a lot of really good rough hunting music. And then they find these wonderful footprints, and they are footprints of what could be translated both as a great stag or as a magic deer. And this amazing deer, they follow these footprints and they come to this very beautiful bridge across a river. And by crossing the river and this magic bridge, they're all transformed into the exact animal that they're seeking to hunt. And then the father comes, as he's lonely, he doesn't understand where the sons have gone, and finds these amazingly beautiful stags. And as his whole habit is, he says, "Oh, now I will shoot you." And one of these stags miraculously starts to speak to him and says, "Don't, because we'll have to tear you apart." And there are lots of ways of looking at this. And in the context of 1930, when he wrote it, I'm not really certain I would want to venture to say what Bartok thought. But clearly one of the aspects of the story is that if you go and just take advantage of the land and use these things and, in a sense, kill some part of its natural beauty, that can come back to haunt you.
David Robertson. The Cantata Profana is in three continuous movements, each with its own symmetry, and Bartók is strongly influenced by Bach in the skillful interweaving of lines, as well as the two soloists, the baritone, who sings the words of the father, and the tenor, who's the eldest of the nine sons and the most magnificent of the stags. There's also a chorus divided into two separate choirs throughout. The piece is notoriously difficult to sing, especially the tenor part, and it's one of the reasons it wasn't instantly performed. In fact, it was the BBC Symphony Orchestra with the wireless chorus, the forerunner of the BBC singers, who first presented the piece in 1934. That applause is for the two soloists, tenor Nicholas Kahn and baritone Ashley Holland, and conductor David Robertson, taking their places on stage with the BBC singers and the BBC Symphony Orchestra for the Cantata Profana by Béla Bartók.
Regnet, was hast du nicht?
Their slender bodies cannot hide in clothing. They must hide among the leaves. They make their tracks not in your hearth's warm ashes, but along the forest floor. They drink their fill not from your silver goblets, but from cool mountain springs. Young men transformed into stags as their father has brought them up to be hunters rather than farmers, and their wild spirits have been seduced by nature red in tooth and claw. Bartok's Cantata Profana, based on a Romanian folk ballad, performed here at the Proms by the current incarnation of the forces that gave that work its first outing in 1934. The BBC singers, joined tonight by the BBC Symphony Chorus and the BBC Symphony Orchestra, conducted at the Proms by David Robertson. And taking their bows now, the two soloists, Nicholas Palm, the tenor, stepping in at short notice to replace Alan Oak, and the baritone, Ashley Holland. And David Robertson returning to the stage together with the chorus director of the BBC Symphony Chorus, Stephen Jackson, who's picking out the soloists from the singers, Olivia Robinson, soprano, Rebecca Lodge, mezzo, Andrew Murgatroyd, tenor, and Edward Price, baritone. And now bringing all of the chorus to their feet. And the orchestra and soloists joining in the applause. The orchestra now being invited to stand. Nicholas Palm was born in Connecticut. He's performed widely across the states in operas and recitals. He's recently recorded Stravinsky's Pulcinella with Pierre Boulez and the Chicago Symphony Orchestra. And Ashley Holland is perhaps better known in European opera houses, including appearing at the Royal Opera House and the Colosseum. And he's performed several times with the Symphony Orchestra under Sir Andrew Davis. Well, to end tonight's prom, the BBC Symphony Orchestra moved from Hungarian music of the 20th century to a symphony by an Austrian composer born in Vienna in the 18th century when Hungary was part of the Austrian Empire. After years working for the princes of Esterházy, Joseph Haydn finally ventured further afield, building on his international reputation, even making a couple of trips to London in the 1790s. He wrote 12 new symphonies for his visits here, glittering examples of his craft, which brought audiences flocking to a series of subscription concerts organised by the violin-playing impresario Johann Peter Salomon. The series ran into trouble on Haydn's second trip to London in 1794, as the French terror in the wake of the revolution made it hard for Salomon to bring in singers here from the continent. Instead, he combined with another violinist and composer, Giovanni Battista Viotti, to organise concerts at the King's Theatre in the Haymarket. The last three of Haydn's 12 London symphonies were written for Viotti's set of concerts in 1795, including the symphony we're going to hear, number 102. That symphony was first performed on the 2nd of February and should really be known as the Miracle Symphony, as during the performance a massive chandelier fell from the ceiling but astonishingly managed to miss everyone in the audience who had surged towards the stage to get a better view of Haydn. For some reason, later reports linked the event with the wrong symphony, number 96, and that one's ended up with a nickname instead. Symphony number 102 is in B-flat major. It's in four movements, with the slow movement second, and it must have been a particular favourite of Haydn's, since he used the same music in one of the piano trios he was composing around the same time. And the introduction is also slow, drawing us in with a sense of mystery before exploding into a vibrant, and for David Robertson, verdant vivace. So why did he choose this symphony to end the prom after Bartok's Cantata Profana?
For reasons I can't really justify, the B-flat major symphony, number 102, is one that for me feels very close to a kind of experience of nature. The very opening of this B-flat for me is like light green. You know, light green, but the type of spring foliage where the light is coming through and all of the leaves are new. There's that kind of quality. The opening harmonic progressions are about as close as he ever came in any of the symphonic introductions to the beginning of the creation. And so there is this real sense of creating this world, which then suddenly has all of this vivacity in it. So there's a whole sense for me of sort of nature involved in this symphony, which is entirely personal. No one else may ever feel this, and a musicologist may come up and say, well, that's total rubbish. But at the same time, it does seem to feel so connected with the world of Bartók, where there is this absolute music, but it is always referring to the real experience of the world around us. And so 102 seems to fit quite nicely.
Conductor David Robertson. Well, Haydn certainly had a fascination with the world around him. He met the astronomer royal William Herschel on his first visit to England in 1792. Herschel was an oboe player. He'd been in the court orchestra in Hanover and had worked as a musician in London, and their friendship was perhaps influential in Haydn going on to compose the creation. But he may also have been influenced by a poem Erasmus Darwin, Charles Darwin's grandfather, called The Botanical Garden. That was published in London not long before, and it conjured up ideas of the Big Bang. Well, whatever the truth, the origins of life, the universe and everything were certainly a talking point in London in the 1790s, which was buzzing with enlightened ideas. Haydn's music, as well as witty, is extraordinarily rational, in tune with the intellectualism of the time. So to conduct the symphony orchestra, here again is David Robertson, for Haydn Symphony number 102.
Thank you. Thank you.
Haydn at his most witty in the rondo that concludes his symphony number 102, first heard in London in 1795 at the Haymarket Theatre, played tonight at the Royal Albert Hall by the BBC Symphony Orchestra, led by Stephen Bryant, conducted by David Robertson. And he was almost acting out each questioning phrase and swift reply there and rewarding the players with a beaming smile at the end of the movement. And he's picking out individual members of the orchestra, including the principal cellist. He's been the orchestra's principal guest conductor since 2005. Born in California, he came to London to study French horn and composition at the Royal Academy before turning to orchestral conducting. And after the excursions into the 20th century, that classical symphony brings this concert back to where it began with Mozart. Haydn and Mozart were good friends. They met in Vienna in the 1780s. And it was apparently hearing Mozart's operas that persuaded Haydn he should give up his own theatrical compositions and concentrate instead on orchestral and chamber music. David Robertson now bringing the wind players to their feet and all the strings. Well, tomorrow night's prom sees the Swedish Chamber Orchestra Örebro, conducted by Thomas Dausgaard, in a tribute to Haydn and also to the film director Tim Burton in a playful new work by Albert Schnelzer. That's together with Schumann's first uncompleted symphony and his fully-fledged second, and Berlioz's Les Nuits d'été, Nina Stemmer, the soloist. That's here in the Albert Hall at 7:30. And at lunchtime, I'll be introducing a Proms chamber music concert from Cadogan Hall that promises to be utterly sublime. Settings of the Song of Songs by Renaissance composers from all across Europe, performed by the vocal ensemble Stile Antico. But with the cheers still ringing around the hall for the BBC Symphony Orchestra, that's all for now. For the rest of this evening's listening on Radio 3, I'll hand you on to Jill Anderson.
Thank you very much. That was Louise Fryer. Well, coming up in 10 minutes or so, our Sunday feature, John Henry Newman, a very English saint. Edward Sturton explores the life of Cardinal John Henry Newman, once described as the most dangerous man in England, because his religious faith took him from Protestantism to the Church of Rome. Newman will be beatified next month during the visit to Britain by Pope Benedict XVI, and the programme includes visits to Newman's former rooms at the Birmingham Oratory and to his grave, where he's buried with his male companion of 32 years. That's our Sunday feature coming up in 10 minutes or so, followed at 10:30 by Words and Music. Struan Roger and Siobhan Redmond read verse and prose on the theme of Enemies by William Blake, Dorothy Parker, Charles Baudelaire, Elizabeth Barrett and Naomi Shibab Nye, with music by Bach, William Walton, Nick Cave and a song from Shirley Bassey. Words and Music is at 10:30 this evening. Well, to take us up to our Sunday feature, let's hear some music by Mozart. This is a quartet in A major, Kirchel 298.
Thank you. Thank you.
Mozart's Flute Quartet in A, K298, was played by the flautist Andreas Blau, with Norbert Breinin, Peter Shidloff and Martin Lovett. Next month, Pope Benedict XVI arrives on a state visit to Britain, and one of the highlights of the trip will be the beatification of Cardinal John Henry Newman, whose life spanned most of the 19th century. It's the penultimate step on the route to sainthood and would make Cardinal Newman the first non-martyred British saint since before the Reformation. Newman was once described as the most dangerous man in England. His religious faith took him from Protestantism to the Church of Rome, earning suspicion on all sides. A prolific writer and theologian who emphasised the role of the imagination and conscience, he is today claimed by liberal and conservative Catholics alike. Even in death, he attracted controversy, requesting to be buried in the same grave as his male companion of 32 years. And mystery still surrounds what happened to Newman's remains. Edward Sturton now examines the life and legacy of John Henry Newman.
In 1816, the 16-year-old John Henry Newman arrived here at Trinity College, Oxford, for the first time. He would have come in through Chapel Arch, which in those days was the main entrance to the college, into Durham Quad, a very intimate quad, which at that period was very much the heart of college life. The hall where the college would dine is just on my left, the library straight ahead, and the chapel on my right. It was the beginning of an association with Oxford that was to last for almost three decades. 1816 was a turbulent period in John Henry Newman's home life. His father's business had just gone bust. It was also a period of great turmoil in the Anglican Church. Geoffrey Rowell is an Anglican bishop and a leading Newman scholar.
There was anxiety because of the threat, as many English churchmen perceived it, to the identity of the church because of legislation that was being passed towards the end of the 1820s, relieving dissenters of disabilities, Catholic emancipation, and 1832, the Great Reform Bill, which had the effect of turning a parliament for which you had to be an Anglican in which to sit as an MP, and which of course was responsible for church legislation, into something which was no longer Anglican. Looking back, we can see it as the beginnings of the emergence of a more pluralist state and the crumbling of a confessional state. In addition to that, you have to look across the channel and the French Revolution, and was there going to be a similar revolution in England? And then, in a rather different way, the evangelical movement associated with John Wesley and Methodism, George Whitefield. If you ask about worship, it was often rather dreary, long sermons, very little in the way of anything which touched the heart, very little perhaps of beauty.
Newman secured a prestigious fellowship at Oriel College and very quickly found himself at the centre of the public debate about the church's future. He decided as a teenager that, as he put it, it was the will of God that I should lead a single life, and in 1825 he was ordained an Anglican priest. He became part of a group of Oxford dons and clergymen with like-minded ideas about renewing the Church of England, which they put forward in a series of pamphlets or tracts. The group became known as the Tractarians, or collectively, the Oxford Movement. It was based around the first of the tightly knit circles of male friends, which were to be such a feature of Newman's life. Newman became the vicar of the University Church of St Mary in Oxford in 1828. And just before he took over the job, the interior of this medieval church had been redesigned to turn it into what's been described as a Calvinist preaching box. So everyone's attention in the church would focus on this raised wooden pulpit. And it was here that Newman really established his reputation as a preacher. Even on the page, his words have impressed people. The novelist Muriel Spark
wrote in an introduction to a selection of his sermons, "It was by way of Newman that I turned Roman Catholic. Not all the beheaded martyrs of Christendom, the ecstatic nuns of Europe, the five proofs of Aquinas, or the pamphlets of my Catholic acquaintance provided anything like the answers that Newman did." And she, of course, had only read the words on the page. His performance was, by all accounts, electric.
One of the things that struck people most about him was his voice.
Father Ian Carr is a leading Newman scholar and biographer.
He had this low, thrilling, musical voice which struck people. It's one of the things that struck them, of course, particularly when he preached. But people remembered that voice. It's echoed through the 19th century. People had intense memories of it.
So a sermon in St Mary's was a real event, was it?
Yes, the heads of colleges changed the dinner hour in order to try and stop undergraduates going, because the sermons were such a central part of the Oxford or Tractarian movement. Such was his magnetic personality that he was drawing young men into the arms of the Oxford movement.
What was the essence of that movement?
Well, the original motivation for the Oxford movement began with the state's interference in the church. So the question naturally that raised itself was, what is the church? That was a fundamental question for the Tractarians. And so they went back to the early fathers and began to rediscover a very Catholic conception of what the church is. Because the evangelicals believed, roughly speaking, the church was simply a sort of convenient place where people could get together and preach Christianity. And the main broad church party believed that it was simply more or less a department of state.
Newman's early Anglicanism was evangelical, and he was deeply suspicious of Roman Catholicism. He took the traditional Protestant view that Rome was corrupt. But when he visited the Eternal City for the first time in the early 1830s, he was in awe of its ancient splendour. He even reflected on the possibility of union between the Roman and Anglican churches, but dismissed it as a dream. On board ship on the way home, he wrote a hymn which evoked a spiritual journey. Newman's willingness to change his mind is one of his most appealing characteristics, and there's an especially attractive modesty of ambition about these lines: "I do not ask to see the distant scene, one step enough for me." "Lead Kindly Light" has become a classic. It was also characteristic of Newman that he found the key to his future in the past. During the 1830s, he turned more and more to the study of the early Christian church, and as he immersed himself in the recondite world of 4th and 5th century theological debate, he saw the contemporary Anglican church reflected in history. He writes of an awful similitude between the dead records of the past and the feverish chronicle of the present. A phrase from the 5th century church father Augustine of Hippo suddenly struck him with, as he put it, "a power which I had never felt from any words before." "Securus judicat orbis terrarum." The whole world is the secure judge, Augustine declared. And to Newman that meant that the Anglican church, tiny in world terms, couldn't simply go its own way. John Cornwall has recently published a biography of John Henry Newman called Newman's Unquiet Grave.
Newman felt that church history teaches us many things about the church today. He saw this continuity between the church from the death of the last apostle right through to the present day. And he was looking for marks of continuity and the integrity of the church. And out of a particular historical incident, a particular heresy, he realized that the Church of England was in heresy. And this meant that his position as an Anglican was untenable.
The last of Newman's pamphlets on Anglicanism, Tract 90, was an attempt to overcome the barriers which divided Roman Catholicism and the Church of England. It was condemned by many of his former Anglican allies and friends, including his bishop, causing Newman great pain. Newman withdrew from Oxford to a small complex of stables and cottages he bought on the outskirts of the city at Littlemore. He established something very close to a monastic community, and the final act in the drama of his conversion was played out there. He was an alchemist with words, forging the gold of great prayer and poetry from his experiences. That's why he's still loved by so many ordinary believers, as well as the theologians who've studied his ideas. One of his best-known prayers emerged from this period of anguish over his parting with Anglicanism.
"May he support us all the day long, till the shades lengthen, and the evening comes and the busy world is hushed, and the fever of life is over, and our work is done. Then, in his mercy, may he give us safe lodging and a holy rest, and peace at the last.
In September 1843, Newman resigned his post as the vicar of St. Mary's the Virgin in Oxford, and later that month he preached his last sermon at Littlemore. It was called The Parting of Friends. In the autumn of 1845, two of his companions at Littlemore were received into the Roman Catholic Church. Newman followed them on October the 9th. Father Ian Carr, Newman's biographer.
They were all in this position of being suspended between the Church of England and the Church of Rome, and one of them decided to seek admittance to the Church of Rome from this extraordinary figure, Father Dominic Barbary, a Passionist missionary who wandered around England in his habit and who had had this conviction when he was a shepherd boy in Italy that he was going to come to England and preach the Catholic faith. And so Barbary was arriving, so Newman thought, this must be the moment that's intended for me. So he asked Barbary to receive him into the church there and then.
It's difficult to overstate what a huge and indeed shocking thing it was for an Anglican clergyman to become a Roman Catholic in the Oxford of the mid-19th century. Newman did eventually come back to Oxford when Trinity made him its first honorary fellow in 1878, but for a long time he was estranged from this place which meant so much to him. I'm in the first rooms he occupied at Trinity. It's a pretty panelled set, but it was right at the back of the college and looked down on the college privy. Yet the view from these windows became, for Newman, a symbol of what he lost when he left here.
I left Oxford for good on Monday, February the 23rd, 1846. I called on Dr. Ogle, one of my very oldest friends, for me was my private tutor when I was an undergraduate. In him, I took leave of my first college, Trinity, which was so dear to me, and which held on its foundations so many who had been kind to me both when I was a boy and all through my Oxford life. Trinity had never been unkind to me. There used to be much snapdragon growing on the walls opposite my freshman's rooms there, and I had for years taken it as the emblem of my own perpetual residence, even unto death, in my university.
It was leaving a whole network of friendship and of church life, and who were you going to join?
The Anglican bishop and Newman scholar, Geoffrey Rowell.
Roman Catholics were very much a minority. On the one hand, there were the old Catholics, the recusant families, rather tightly knit, rather conservative. And on the other hand, the influx of Irish Catholics coming to look for work, not very sophisticated, not very intellectual. And then again, there was a strong strand of no popery, anti-Catholicism, and, you know, to someone of Newman's subtlety of mind to have made that choice was really to go and join a church that many people thought was of the devil.
So much for the verdict of the world he was leaving behind, but what about the world he was joining? Archbishop Vincent Nichols is the leader of the Roman Catholic Church in England and Wales.
My impression is that Newman's arrival in the Catholic community was not easy, and it was difficult both for him as he left his friends behind, and he suffered greatly because of that. And it was difficult, I think, for the newly established hierarchy to know what to do with this rather exotic figure. He was such an Oxford figure that I don't think it was easy for this emerging community, who were only just beginning to present themselves again in the emerging cities, out of the countryside, out from under the protection of the Catholic families in their houses. It wasn't easy to know how to relate to this man.
After his conversion, John Henry Newman travelled to Rome, and the next step on his religious journey saw him ordained as a Catholic priest. In Rome, he came to know the Oratorian order. Oratorian priests live together in small communities, usually in city centres. They're different from monks in the sense that they're very much involved in the world around them and don't take vows like poverty and obedience. Father Newman decided to establish the order in Britain. If Oxford was the stage where Newman's life as an Anglican was played out, this place, the Oratory in Birmingham, is most closely associated with his time as a Catholic. He came here in 1852 and lived here right up until his death in 1890.
I'm in the library. It's a wonderful airy room, stacked with books from floor to ceiling, and I'm with the provost, who's Father Richard Duffield. Why did the Oratorian order attract Henry Newman?
He'd already been living a kind of religious life a little more with companions who became Catholics with him. Had they chosen the diocesan priesthood, they'd have been scattered to different parishes. Had he become a Jesuit, he might have been sent to some other part of the world. They'd have all been separated.
You're leaning rather nonchalantly on this magnificent wooden desk here. This has a special part to play in his story, doesn't it?
Yes, this is a stand-up desk. He stood at this desk to write. Especially, he wrote at this desk the Apologia Pro Vita Sua, his spiritual autobiography. Newman had been accused by Charles Kingsley, who was the professor of history at Cambridge and also, of course, the author of The Water Babies and Alton Locke. He'd written a review of James Anthony Froude's History of England, and in the review, Kingsley said that Dr. Newman assures us that truth is not or need not be a virtue with the Roman clergy. And so he felt he had to defend himself and defend the church. He wrote to Kingsley as one English gentleman to another. Kingsley wrote back and didn't really apologise. Then there was a short pamphlet war, Kingsley writing a pamphlet called What Then Does Dr. Newman Mean? And Newman wrote back very acidly, well, mean it, I maintain I never said it. And he realised that the only way he could really defend what he'd done in his life was by writing the whole history of his religious opinions. Because really what Kingsley was saying was, all the time you were in the Church of England, you were really a secret Catholic. And Newman's had to defend himself against that charge by saying that he'd moved very slowly because there were authentic, real religious problems he had to work out in his own mind before he moved further onto the next stage. The book was published in serial form. From February to May 1864, Newman was writing at this desk for 16 or 17 hours a day.
Gosh.
And he writes in his diaries that it's amazing he could write any more to write a diary. My fingers have walked 20 miles over the paper today, because he was just exhausted doing it. The printer's boy came on Thursdays. They took the manuscript down to the door, the ink still wet on the page. And, of course, the Apologia changed everything, because Newman's power is that he doesn't just change people's minds, but by the power of his prose, he's able to change people's imaginations. And people could imagine themselves being affected and changed by these real religious questions.
This is the library where he wrote that great book. You also have downstairs the room where he lived, slept, said Mass, prayed. Shall we go and have a look?
Let's go.
And here we are. It's quite dark, the curtains are all drawn. There are bookshelves either side of the fireplace here on my right, and in the middle of the room, a desk with another rack of books. And this is exactly as it would have been when he died.
Yes, it's exactly as it was. We've dusted, but otherwise we've not done very much.
So as well as being a shrine to him, this is an insight into what life would have been like here in the late 19th century. There's a gas lamp on the desk, I see.
The lamps are fascinating. There are two of them on his desk. There's an oil lamp and a candle lamp. When I was a novice, and I used to give this guided tour regularly, we always said this small candlelight was given to him by Gladstone. But now I've noticed that the novices say that the large oil lamp was given by Gladstone. But, of course, Newman and Gladstone corresponded a lot. We have the letters still in our archives. They knew each other.
There's a screen up ahead of us, a wooden screen, with a crucifix standing on the bookshelf. And behind it, I can just glimpse a sort of purple cap of some sort with a cross on top. What goes on behind the screen?
Well, I'll take you behind to show you, but it's quite interesting. An oratorian is given one room to live in for the whole of their lives, and it should be comfortable, it should be homely. But Newman's bed was behind that screen originally. When he was made a cardinal in 1879, the rule of the church at that time was that a cardinal who was not a bishop of a diocese had to reside in Rome. Newman wrote to the Holy Father to say, may I carry on living in Birmingham? May I have a dispensation? It was readily granted, so long as he lived in the state, becoming a cardinal. And so while he was away in Rome getting his cardinal's hat, he was given another bedroom. And I'll take you behind to show you the chapel that was fitted out.
So what was his bedroom became his private chapel?
Yes.
Oh, it's charming, isn't it? Tiny little
here it
chapel.
Is. Tiny. It's tiny but perfectly formed. A little baldacchino, what you call the cap, is in fact a little velvet dome above the altar. We have Newman's chalices in these boxes.
A beautiful gold chalice.
That's right. I'm going to lend it to the Pope for the papal mass.
He's going to use that to say
Well,
mass.
I hope so. I've not cleared that with his MC yet, but I think he'll want to.
It's a remarkable thing to have preserved this place like this. What was the thinking behind that?
Well, I think there was a strong sense, even at the time of Newman's death, that this was a really remarkable man, possibly even a saint. And certainly here in his community, among the priests he'd lived with, they wanted to keep it as it was.
Just outside John Henry Newman's room is a very striking picture on the wall of two young men, both dressed in black, sitting at a table, both at their books, which are open in front of them. This is John Henry Newman
on the left,
Ambrose St. John, his close friend, on the right. That's what were right. the circumstances in which this picture was painted?
This is painted almost immediately after they both became Catholics, and they are in Rome studying to become priests at the Collegio di Propaganda Fide.
Tell me a bit more about the relationship between them.
St. John was very much younger than Newman. He was the chap who was really with Newman, faithful to him all the time, from Littlemore right to St. John's death in the 1870s. And so I think Newman relied on him for all sorts of things, practicalities, for translations, for helping running the school. And they were soulmates in a certain sense, I think.
You've no doubt in your mind that it was a chaste relationship?
None whatsoever, no.
What do you make of the controversies there have been about it?
Well, I think it's very sad that friendship should always have to be eroticised, really, and to be seen in those essentially post-Freudian terms. Newman would never have seen things in those ways. He'd have been very shocked and scandalised to think it would have been seen in that way at all. I think it's a diminution of the power of real friendship, and anybody who has a real friend whom they've had for years, who knows them intimately, but with whom they're not in love in the physical sense, would be shocked by such an impoverished understanding of friendship.
The question mark over Newman's sexuality is not entirely a modern invention. Some of his contemporaries remarked on what they saw as his effeminate manner and appearance. John Cornwall.
Having read through most of the 32 great fat volumes of Newman's letters, one doesn't get much of a sense of sexual libido coming out. I don't think that he was interested sexually either with men or with women. I see the friendship with Ambrose as being an essential helpmate to him. After all, he was one of the really great writers of his age, a prodigious literary workaholic, and he needed somebody to help him through everyday life, somebody to rely upon. There was a deep emotional attachment, I think, but I think it's clear that it was absolutely non-sexual. Indeed, when Newman was criticised by one of his oratorium confreres for having a special friendship, Newman replied,
"As to particular friendships, I have much wished a definition of what it meant. St. James and St. John had a sort of particular friendship among the apostles, so must brothers in a congregation ever. That is, there must be feelings between them which are not between others. The point, I conceive, is that they should not show it, should not act upon it. To me now, the hopeless thing is this, that when the idea has once got into people's minds, it cannot get out. For if from circumstances I have been brought closer to Father Ambrose than to others, let me hide the fact as I will. I can do nothing to undo it. Unless I actually did cease to love him as well as I do."
Newman was once memorably described by another prominent Catholic convert of the day, Cardinal Manning, as a great hater. But there's plenty of evidence of his talent for friendship too, with women as well as men. Melanie McDonough is a Catholic writer who used her newspaper column to join battle in the recent controversy over Newman's relationships.
And it's worth considering that he got on much better with his sisters than with his two brothers. He looked after his mother and his sisters, even though he was a don and a clergyman. after the father's death, when the family circumstances were very much reduced. The other female friendships were equally important to him. He had a great friend, Maria Gibbon. She was very beautiful, rather buxom, dark. One gets the impression of slightly larger-than-life character. When they both went at one point to Rome to visit the Pope, Pius IX, Newman kissed the Pope's toe, and Maria Gibbon grabbed his foot, and Newman said, rather laughingly afterwards, that he thought the poor old Pope was going to be knocked backwards. She seized him with such force. But because he'd turned his back on the idea of marriage, he was a very possessive person. He was jealous of his friendships in the old sense that he felt of them as his. And it was interesting that when his sister Harriet married Tom Moseley, who was a clergyman, he was upset about it. When his friends were lost to him through marriage, and he did very much feel that they were lost to him through marriage, that was something he resented because he felt, quite rightly, that once they were married, they weren't going to be available for those intimate friendships that they had been before.
Those old-fashioned Donish communities are marked very often by close friendships. They're also sometimes a bit catty, those communities. Did he show any symptoms of cattiness, do you think?
Oh, absolutely. Yes, his correspondence is littered with instances of barbed sort of wit and a good deal of waspishness. And it came out in particular episodes. There was one letter when he complained bitterly that one of the brothers had taken the cocoa, and he wrote at some length about his hopelessness in terms of the domestic environment. And at Edgbaston, at the community there, there was one poor chap who'd offended him in some way early on in their life together, and for 20 years Newman just cut him. He just didn't have a word to say to him thereafter, and the poor chap never quite knew what it was that had put his nose out of joint. But yes, he did have a capacity for slight queeniness, but that doesn't gainsay his other capacity, which was for a great openness in his friendships. He didn't believe in bottling it up.
I'm in what was Cardinal Newman's bathroom, where he took a cold shower every morning, and this room is now absolutely packed with piles of boxes, some of them hidden under plastic sheeting, one of them rather a tottering tower of boxes here under a cardinal's hat. And these, Father Richard, are the originals, if I understand it right, the originals of everything Cardinal Newman wrote here.
Yes, all 17,777 letters that we know about, all his manuscripts, they're all here in boxes waiting until we've built an archive so that they can be safely stored.
Could we look at a couple? I mean, this one, for example, I see archive box one. It's got written on the side, letter to the Duke of Norfolk, a reference that presumably to that very famous pamphlet in which he wrote about the question of conscience.
Let's have a look.
And there it is.
There it is.
That tiny, very, very neat writing.
Yes.
Beautiful writing. And the great quote from that letter is where he said, "Certainly if I'm obliged to bring religion into after-dinner toasts, I shall drink to the Pope, if you please, still to conscience first and to the Pope afterwards," which a lot of people have read as his rallying cry, if you like, for the importance of conscience.
Yes, of course, it's Newman's most famous soundbite, and it's often used as if Newman is being derogatory to the Pope. I don't think the two are mutually exclusive. We can't work out our faith for ourselves by the natural light of human reason. We need revelation, we need the Church, and in some sense we need the authoritative teaching of the Pope to guide us.
Father Richard Duffield, the provost of the Birmingham Oratory, touching on one of the most controversial aspects of Newman's thinking. Newman the convert was a great trophy for the Vatican and the newly established English Catholic hierarchy, but his ideas often brought him into conflict with the church authorities. One Vatican Monsignor called him the most dangerous man in England. He was a champion of the role of laypeople in church life, and he had doubts about the decision to declare the doctrine of papal infallibility in 1870. Partly because of those views, he had a distinctly scratchy relationship with Cardinal Manning, who led the English church from 1865 until his death in 1892. Archbishop Vincent Nichols has Manning's job today.
He was quite clear that there needs to be a point of authority. But towards the end of the Apologia, the imagery he uses to describe the role of infallibility is really very dramatic. He takes his imagery from the Industrial Revolution that's taking place at the time. So he refers to the smelting of iron, which is a very dramatic process. And he says the exchange between our reasoned human nature and its quest for truth and the infallible magisterium of the Church is like that.
It is the custom with Protestant writers to consider that, whereas there are two great principles in action in the history of religion, authority and private judgment,